So hello and welcome to a very special episode of Bone Up. It's one of those episodes where Richie and I have got on a plane and we're here at the European Calcified Tissue Society Congress in Marseille in the south of France to give you a little flavour of what goes on here. So Richie, bonjour, ça va?
Bonjour, ça va? We've come to ECTS, listeners, to give you a bit of a flavour of what's happened in bone research in the last year, tell you about the highlights, introduce you to some of the prize winners at the conference, get the voices of some young scientists, the people who are doing the research that are going to develop the next generation cures. We're going to talk to some of the senior profs and look back at their, you know, lifetime of work and how they've developed the drugs and medicines which you might be taking. And we're also going to talk to some of the ECTS members, the people who run the society, especially the ones who do a lot of work to support young scientists. It's very difficult when you're starting a career, and the ECTS are doing a lot of really good work, and we'd like to bring some of that to you.
Yeah, so we hope if you're a patient, you'll be reassured listening to the research, listening to the scientists, and if you're a young doctor or a young scientist, maybe we'll stimulate your interest as to what actually goes on at these conferences.
And maybe you might want to come to one in the future and we'll see you there.
So we're delighted, and this is an interview I'm very excited about. We have Thomas Funk Brentano with us, working in Paris at the moment. And Thomas presented yesterday, telling us about the latest and most exciting research across the world of bone disease in the last year. Thomas, I have to tell you, I'm at the conference here. When I go back to work next week, my patients will say to me, so you've been to the big conference. Tell us what's coming up next. What's the most exciting research? And you're the man to give us the answers.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much. It was actually a very exciting task to review all the exciting science that is out there. And of course, we needed to do some selections. So I think what I remind is the new anabolic agents, that there's increasing evidence that they're effectiveness in reducing fractures is higher than bisphosphonates.
Yeah.
And that perhaps we really need to reflect on in like which position we should give these bone agents to our patients.
And by that you mean drugs like romosozumab, teriparatide, abaloparatide, those sorts of drugs?
Yeah, exactly. These kind of drugs that promote bone formation rather than inhibiting bone resorption. I think it's really a good opportunity. Of course, it is sub-Q injections in general, and some of our patients are not so happy with that,
yeah.
And we can understand. There's this particular study that was very interesting is to try to capture which patients would respond the most with these agents, and looking at genetics. And they were able to actually to find that if you have certain alleles, certain variants, you might respond very nicely compared to other alleles. So in a strategy in the future, that could be interesting, actually, to try to capture this information so that we're really sure that despite the burden of the treatment, it will actually turn out to be very efficient.
Yeah, that's one of the things when a patient, particularly if a patient becomes so invested in the condition that they're injecting themselves every morning for a year, for 2 years, and I'm able to use bone turnover markers, and I do contact patients and say your bone turnover has increased, that's good news, and people are encouraged by that. The idea that we could tell people before they started that you have a gene profile, which means you're really susceptible to this treatment in a good way,
yeah.
That would be very encouraging, you think, for patients?
Oh, yes, I definitely think that it is encouraging. And on the other hand, if we think that they would not respond, that perhaps we would not push too much. Of course, it's a preliminary data. Well, it's a big study already, but it needs to be enlarged and confirmed with other data before we turn it into clinical practice, I think. But I think it's a very interesting idea.
Because we see that a lot with cancer treatments now, where the oncologist will do genetic test to choose the treatment, but we're not really with at that stage yet with osteoporosis.
But that's the global idea of that study. So I thought it was really interesting and needed to be mentioned. Other options to try to decrease the burden of these sub-Q injections is other routes of administration, such as oral PTH or transdermal PTH, and there are some increasing studies, number of studies that are interested in that, and that's very promising, I think.
Almost the most exciting thing I thought from all the work you summarized yesterday was the idea of oral anabolic agents, because that would make it so much more widely available to my patients. It would make it more acceptable to them, and I think we would then involve primary care as well, because we want to get treatment early with anabolic agents, but people have to come to the hospital to see me, to be seen. Whereas if it was tablet form, I could get GP colleagues that could be started in primary care, monitored. It would just be a paradigm shift in how we treat things.
I do agree. I think the phase two study was giving some promising results with increase in bone turnover markers for bone formation and increase in bone mineral density. Of course, it needs to go further in the steps of clinical trials to be confirmed that is in fact effective, but it's going to be very interesting to follow these studies.
My fracture liaison nurses would love to hear that, because it would be less work for them as well.
Thinking ahead now, how would it be practical to bring in genetic testing into healthcare for bone treatment? The kind of equipment, I guess, you need to do the genetic profiling, is that something you normally have in hospitals? Do you have to send out to a lab? How would it work on a big scale?
Yeah, so that's an important question. I'm probably not fully sure about the answer, but what I can see is that genetic testing, large scale, is getting easier and easier and less expensive with time. So I'm pretty sure that some companies would, be able to do these tests, these screenings. So this is a whole other question, and I'm probably not the genetic expert to have all the pros and cons. But it's going to be interesting, I think, to see what goes on in the upcoming 5 to 10 years.
I think one of the other things you mentioned as well in some of the studies about denosumab, which we all use lots of and is very exciting, but a lot of people are asking, how do I get my patient off denosumab again? Should I be getting my patient off denosumab again?
Yeah, this is a very, very important field. There's a growing evidence in osteoporosis, and actually the study that I mentioned was in a very particular situation of end-stage renal disease with patients under dialysis. And there was this very interesting study that were able to look at bone hip strength indices using, derived from DEXA in 124 patients treated for up to 5 years. And, there were some promising results with these indices going up, so improving with denosumab treatment. But 11 of these patients discontinued denosumab and were followed for another year. And as we could have expected, but I think it's one of the first that actually demonstrates that in this population, that these improvements, they disappear. So then what to do? Because you can always give bisphosphonates in non-CKD patients to try to...
Limit the off effect,
exactly.
but not with renal failure.
Exactly. So I think the use of denosumab is really tricky, and we really need to improve our knowledge in this situation. And the second thing that is, I think, very important for the community to insist on is the risk of severe hypocalcemia in these patients with denosumab. And the main message is that it's frequent, so you need to know that it's a very high possibility. and that you need to work in hands to hands, hands in hands with the nephrologist, so that you can try to prevent this.
I don't know if you see the same in France, but certainly I see maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, my renal physician colleagues would have used denosumab themselves, would have managed that themselves. Now they're referring lots of those patients to the osteoporosis clinic to me because they perceive it's quite complex.
Yeah.
And as you say, you can't really come off denosumab if you've got end-stage renal disease because you can't use a bisphosphonate. But I did think it was reassuring from the work that you, the paper that you covered that showed that it actually was effective. Because yeah. Some people would have said if you've very low bone turnover because of your renal disease, trying to lower it further with denosumab may not help. But actually you showed a paper that suggested that it did have some benefits.
Well, yes. So the limitation of this study is that we didn't really know what kind of renal osteodystrophy had. And exactly what, as you said, we didn't know if those patients with low bone turnover or adynamic bone also responded in this way.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for speaking to us today. Your talk was incredibly well received. I think it's one of the best at the conference.
Thank you very much. I'm very honored.
And thank you for answering our questions today. I think the listeners at home are going to be really interested to hear what you had to say.
Yeah, both my patients and fracture liaison nurses will be delighted to hear all about what you were saying.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I was just a storyteller here, but...
You are passing on the work of others, but that's okay. In this case, we'll praise the messenger. Okay.
The storytelling is the hard bit. You know? And it's such a huge volume of information to get across, to synthesize everything and put it together and pick out the highlights. Just, I suppose, one last question. How long did it take?
A few weekends. I actually really started 2 weekends ago, and I had a short night just before.
There you have it, listeners, working through the night to bring you the latest bone research. Thank you, Thomas.
Thanks very much, Thomas.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Listeners, David and I have been at the conference for the first half day now, and one of the things that really seems to be standing out is research into diabetes. It really seems to be taking the conference by storm, and to prove that, we've got two prize winners here. We've got the clinical award prize winner, Lorenza Mattia, and we've got the basic science award winner, Tessa Crapper. Welcome both of you to the podcast.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
So it's really interesting that both prizes this year have been given out for diabetes research. Lorenza, I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about the work that you've been doing.
Yes, thank you. And diabetes is a worldwide disease, so this is probably, it is important to study also from the bone metabolism point of view. So I'm an endocrinologist and I've studied diabetes and bone metabolism since the last 3-4 years during my PhD. And we know that type 2 diabetes is a condition characterized by an increased risk of fracture, and is important because it is a huge burden for our societies from an economical and social point of view. So it is important to increase the research in this field. In my little research, I have studied some biomarkers that could be involved in the increasing the risk of fracture in this population. And in particular, I focus my attention on the growth differentiation factor 15, which is a senescence biomarker. And I've seen that this increase in type 2 diabetes, it might be linked to increased risk of fracture. But in particular, I've studied the effect of exercise training on this biomarker. And we know that exercise training could reduce the fracture risk, but we don't know what it can do on this biomarker. So I've studied this effect of exercise training in a population of type 2 diabetes to see which are the changes of GDF15 after 2 years of exercise training.
So you're following patients with diabetes for 2 years then, and you're monitoring the changes in the biomarker, which is a biomarker for senescence, for aging, and also for the diabetes disease. What happens to the biomarkers in the people who are exercising?
So in people who exercised, the biomarkers decreased, and on the other side, it increased, significantly increased in people who did not do any exercise training. So the key result might be that exercise could somehow reduce this senescence biomarker, and or maybe is associated with a reduction of this biomarker. And we also think that if GDF15 might be involved in the fracture risk in type 2 diabetes, we think that his effect might be related not to an effect on bone metabolism, but to muscle, on muscle function rather than bone.
It's something we've come across before in other episodes of the podcast, the link between muscle and bone. So the patients who exercised, did they get an increase in their diabetic control? Did their glycemic control improve as well as their bone health? And was there a relationship between improving glycemic control and improving bone health?
Actually, we didn't find this relationship, but the glycemic control was improved in those who exercised, and it is, confirmed by several other research on this field, which exercise is able to improve glucose control. Actually, we didn't find any correlation with the better glucose control and bone outcomes, but we had a small sample of patients, so probably we need to do more research in this field. And
so where do you think you go next then? If you could wave your magic wand and have all the money and resources in the world, what would you like to do?
So if I were very rich and then have all the fundings, I think we need to study the changes of these biomarkers from baseline and follow up for more than 2 years to check if there is an effect on the fracture risk, because you need longer time to see the effect of the fracture outcome, because so far we just looked at the bone density, bone turnover, and we know that GDF15 is not related to bone, but it is related to muscle function, in improvement of muscle function. So what we need now is to check if there is also an effect on the fracture risk, but we need more time to establish this.
So let me ask you this. If we were at a diabetes conference today instead of a bone conference, would the diabetes experts be talking about bone? And if not, why not?
Yeah, this is
it's a good question.
Very impolite question.
No,
because
no,
I am
perfectly polite.
Yeah, perfectly polite. So probably not enough, at least. The last conferences have been about diabetes. I didn't find any talk about bone. I hope in the next future I will find more bone metabolism talk and topics. Probably I will bring my research there. This is my next step for October.
People with diabetes, patients even need to know this as well, don't they? They're educated about kidney disease, about eye disease. They're not told that their bones are at risk of diabetes as well.
Yeah, you're right. We need to start thinking about bone as another chronic complication of the disease.
Of diabetes,
Yes.
So, studying patients is difficult. Studying the mechanisms and causes underlying disease is very hard, listeners, as you might know, because humans have long and complicated lives with complex physiology. So it's really important we have the basic science too. And Tessa, this is probably a really good time to bring you in. We had a discussion before we started recording about basic science, and somebody said actually there's probably a better word for it, but I've forgotten what that was.
Fundamental was the word suggested,
Fundamental science. You know, as myself, I'm a basic scientist. Would you be able to tell us about your work?
Okay. I worked with the zebrafish model to look at bone formation and bone regeneration under high glucose conditions. And the zebrafish serves it as a suitable model to address skeletal complications in diabetic research, because my findings are consistent to those that have been made in diabetic human bones. That is, I just did an overview. Is there any differences? Because just two studies have have looked at bone tissue in diabetic zebrafish, and they just investigated the scales and the fins. So I was the first one to look at the bone.
Wow.
So, and then at the zebrafish larva, there I could prove that the number of osteoblasts were reduced during bone formation. And during bone regeneration, I could also show that the number of osteoblasts was reduced.
I'm going to ask, as a clinician who doesn't understand this, so these fish are bred to have diabetes from birth, or you do something to the fish that gives them diabetes, and then you look at their bones? Which of the two?
I give them diabetes,
and then you measure their bones?
By incubating them in high glucose.
Okay.
Or with a nitroreductase-mediated cell ablation of the beta cells. And that's a possibility where you can enable either type 1 or type 2 diabetes. We know that bone mineral density differs between those types, and this would be also a nice topic for further research, because I looked at both types of diabetes, but there need to be more research on the molecular level and more stuff to look. Is there a difference? It's also in the model organism and not just in humans.
Which type of diabetes is worse, do you think, for bone? Type 1 or type 2?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess type 1, because there is an absolute lack of insulin, and we know that insulin is anabolic to the bone, and we have an autoimmune disease with higher pro-inflammatory status and metabolism. I guess that will enhance this bone.
Bone loss, yes. Yeah, inflammation and, enhances bone loss, yeah.
And you get it earlier.
Yeah.
So we have, you will live longer with the diagnosis of type 1 diabetes. So, diabetes is a disease of long-term complications. Not I will get diabetes and in 2 months I will show bone fragility.
Yeah.
It's causing over the years not only the nerves, the brain or the kidneys, but
the bone as well.
Bone,
yeah, we should have asked Lorenza that question as well then. So which is worse for your bones from your point of view, Lorenza, type 1 or type 2?
So thank you for this tricky question for a diabetologist, because actually both have lots of problems, and probably from the bone point of view, we have several differences between the two types of diabetes. Of course, type 1 diabetes, people with type 1 diabetes have a longer longer duration of disease. So we expect to follow them from the early childhood or adolescence to the old, the elderly, elderly age.
Yeah.
So there's a long duration of the disease, so bone might be involved
more. Yeah, it's because I would have, if you'd asked me, I would have said, well, in theory it would be type 1, but then when I see patients at the clinic, so many people with type 2 diabetes perhaps have been smokers, have taken steroid, have lots of other risk factors, whereas perhaps the type 1 diabetics have been careful not to smoke, to exercise, to look at their other risk factors. So probably at the basic model, it's type 1, but at the clinical model with the real human beings making bad lifestyle choices, it's type 2.
Yeah, probably it's true, because type 2 diabetes have worse lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are inactive. As you said, they smoke more. Cardiovascular disease, so yeah, you're right.
The listeners at home might be thinking it's a bit strange that we can be at a bone conference and we have clinicians alongside basic scientists studying fish as a model. I mean, it sounds a bit crazy, right?
Yeah, it sounds crazy.
Why do you pick zebrafish as a model? I think maybe most people would think about mice or rats or dogs or something. Mm. Why fish?
Fish, because they're easily to hostage. You can put them in a small tank and they're happily together in a big tank, and they have a short development time, and they're very easy to create transgenic lines. There's, for example, there I work with a model with an insulin mutant. With they have a deletion of 60 base pairs, and then they are not able to create the insulin and get diabetes. Or it's possible to create fluorescent proteins that are expressed the bone to image them, and so many others.
Yeah, so it's easy to do science.
It's pretty easy, yeah. And the lava is also nice to have because you can easily regenerate it in a short time. It's easy to handle, and they are also invisible in the first 5 days. Mm. So it's live in vivo imaging is possible.
I wonder if there might be some collaboration one day. We saw some great talks about collaborations between human and mouse scientists today.
Yeah,
hopefully.
I hope zebrafish will become a rising star.
Well, that's great. Look, thank you for taking the time to speak us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, listeners, next up we have an interview with the co-chairs of the ECTS Academy, Alex and Jeroen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
So we'd like to chat to you a bit about the ECTS Academy and how it fits alongside your kind of, you know, work lives and research lives, because it must be a big investment for you. It seems like the society has really got behind the ECTS Academy. Could you tell us about your role and what are your hopes for the Academy?
Yeah, so we're the co-chairs, so our responsibility is to kind of organise the group of about 30 early career academics and do different activities from sessions at the conference to we have a retreat once a year. We also do online mentoring. We have our own networking sessions, etc. So we are the secretaries, coordinators, chief cat rabblers, yeah.
And I think the interesting aspect is basically, because it's such a diverse group of members, basically, clinicians and basic scientists, and the mission of ECTS is also to bring together these different disciplines. Although to realize that at a conference is typically a bit more challenging, because sessions are typically topic-based. So having an interaction at a society level is a bit more complicated, but it's something that actually within the academy, something that's very prominent, because we host several events focused on our personal career development, and that forces us basically to understand what everyone is doing. And that's a very good experience. And I would like to add, I think what has been very useful also in terms of my professional development, first of all, you're leading a group of 30 people. So
it's a big group.
Exactly. So your laboratory tends to be smaller. I mean, mostly for us in our career stage. Mm-hmm. And then you also realize what the challenges are, also dealing with different cultural backgrounds, also different disciplines, working hours. So that's a very good lesson. And other than that, I think what's also really helpful is to understand how a society actually works and how you can contribute to the mission and vision of the society. So to interact also with the board, because that's decision making at a different level. It's interaction also with sponsors. It's different people and members wanting something from a society. And it's a very insightful lesson, because along our career path, somewhere down the line, we're gonna end up in these positions also. Mm-hmm. And most of them actually grow into this position without being trained to be in this position. We have never had received specific training for management or leading groups. So this is just an experience with support of the ECTS. That's really, I think I'm really grateful for being able to experience this.
And can you outline for us just sort of exactly what the Academy does, or just to give a couple of headings, because some people listening to the podcast, you know, won't necessarily know. What do you do sort of practically week by week to achieve your goals?
So it's online meetings across the year, because we're based all across Europe. Mm-hmm. And then twice a year we have the opportunity to get together. So I mentioned there was a retreat, so we have 2 to 3 days dedicated where we're all together. And what we really try and do is maximize that time and just think, what are the things that couldn't possibly work online? So I think open table discussions, mm-hmm. very difficult to replicate that conference in-person experience. So we try and make it as interactive as possible, and all the kind of admin we push off into online meetings. And then at the conference, we do a lot. There's a lot of academy sessions. So there's a mentoring session where we get senior scientists to talk with early career researchers about different topics that are relevant to them. So publishing in big journals, networking, etc. We have a couple of sessions that we run where we select from the abstracts from early career researchers that weren't selected for the main program, and we have 18 opportunities for presentations. So I think that's a really valuable thing, because you're very squeezed, and it's a big learning curve, isn't it, speaking in front of a couple of
hundred people. And you get great confidence as a more earlier career grade researcher, clinician, coming to a conference and speaking, don't
absolutely
you?
Yeah.
I think also it serves, you know, for the image of the society as well. It is very good to have to reinforce the mission of ECTS, showing that we are also there for ECRs. And I've been going also to different meetings, larger meetings typically, maybe also more clinicians, and the atmosphere at these conferences tends to be different. The content is different. The speakers are different. It's more prominent. It's based indeed on publication status, on status in the field, seniority. And I think what ECTS does really well is to really emphasize on the ECR members, and actually also leave that in our hands, I think, as the Academy. Like, they give us lots of tools in our hands to help create this program, basically, really for the ECRs. So I think, and it's also what they like a lot, is that they will come back for that. And this reinforces also their connection with ECTS, and feeling basically at home with a society, which is, in your professional career, this is something that you will need to do eventually.
And that's really important.
Yes.
I really like ECTS. It's a very friendly conference. I do feel at home here. I feel that other people feel at home here. You mentioned earlier on about how sometimes it's difficult to get scientists from different backgrounds together, and you talked about clinical and basic science. Yeah, a lot of conferences only tend to have one or the other. ECTS has a very good mix. David, you'll know about this. Sometimes it's hard to get clinicians to come to conference because they've got really crazy, busy lives. ECTS does that very well. And I wonder if it's because of this holistic approach that you're taking. Being a young scientist is so hard. It's so difficult to develop your career, get a staff position, and then build your profile. It's really amazing that you're supporting people through them, really their most difficult years.
And if I was a younger researcher or younger clinician, and I had an idea of something that I would maybe want the Academy to do, I take it you're sort of open to that, responsive to sort of facilitate and help people?
Yeah, definitely, because I think this program was initiated 7 or 9 years ago. Initially started out with a small group of people, I think 7 or 8 initially, and it steadily grew over time. Now we are 32 members currently. We already have 33 alumni, and it means that we actually have lots of hands available for different projects. So we have the activities that Alex already explained that we are running on an annual basis, but we're also every year we're reviewing our activities and trying to think of what is something new that we can do, or should we revise our current content. We actually did that this year. We did an outreach to the different society program at the conference previously, and now we decided to put a much more prominent slot in the program, highlighting our own activities and explaining the transparency and fairness behind the recruitment process, and also explaining that we are not an elite organ operating by itself, but actually we like to collaborate with any ECTS member, and we're open for input from anyone.
I think that's an important thing, is that when you look at how it's building, it isn't just a select few. So 5 to 7 people come in to a year, which might seem quite restricted, but as you were saying, it's now 65 people have either completed or are in the programme. So we think another 10 years, we're talking 150 people, presumably the majority at the conference, will have been through that, and there's kind of a kinship. Well, you know, there is a big social element to it, as well as a scientific really good, element. And it's that idea that hopefully these are the professors, the leaders of the field of the future, and that you get them working scientifically, get a good kind of atmosphere, collegiality between them, that makes for a more productive, friendly approach to the field.
You're growing a big family. So if there's somebody listening to this now, a young scientist who might want to get involved, how would they go about joining and applying?
So there's an annual call. So this comes up late in the year, and you will be asked to submit a form which kind of indicates how you fit with different criteria. So it will be details of your publications, it will be details of your grants, education, etc. Also your service to learned societies, because we want people who've shown that ability, that collegiality, to go above and beyond papers and money to contribute to the field. And then you also write a motivation letter that really helps us to understand why you want to do this, and you will have references. So approach us and ask us for advice about this, because I think there's also, we've talked a lot about this over the last year, there's really a perfect point, or perfect points when people could apply. I think you can technically apply after your PhD, but I think only very exceptional individuals, and certainly I wouldn't count myself amongst them, would be mature enough and have the work position where they could best take advantage of it. Because, you know, you think in your first postdoc, you're still really learning. You probably have it's a bit difficult to get hold of a project. You're getting hold of a project for the first time, probably learning new literature. So that's quite challenging, and probably you don't have the capacity to go and do new projects and commit to new things. Whereas in your second postdoc, perhaps, or a bit more experience towards the end of your postdoc, you've probably got more freedom from your PI, or you might have a fellowship that you can initiate your own projects. You're more confident, you've developed better skills. So it's not an indication of it against you if you don't, you know, you're not successful early on. It may just be you need... It may be a better fit to you later on in that 10-year window. So you can apply up to 10 years after your PhD and perhaps think about, you know yourself, and maybe speak to perhaps mentors or senior colleagues and think, am I in the position where I could best take advantage of this opportunity?
Mm. It sounds like a really big time commitment that you both have to make, the residential weekends, the meetings and things. How does this work alongside your day jobs as being academics, researchers and clinicians? Does it help you?
It does definitely help, I think. I mean, if you look at the life of a scientist nowadays, it's, I would say, 80% administration anyways. So this is just another thing to administer, of course. But I think the big difference is also that because you contribute to the mission of a society, it's also quite fulfilling to do. I think I would like to emphasize also on the fact that why maybe you're alluding also or asking about the fact, how did this help my career also? Mm-hmm. So there it has been, maybe it's anecdotal, but I don't think so. I think it highlights one of the missions of the society. So I was working, I'm entering into a new field where there's not too much literature basically available. And just by serendipity, I was learning about clinical colleagues within the academy that are working in the diabetes field and trying to use the same type of drugs that I'm actually interested in testing in an osteoarthritis condition. And while we were both sharing experiences we did an exercise at the last retreat where we said, please in one line explain what your topic is about and what line of research you would be interested in pursuing in a collaborative effort. And well, when you find out that you're basically with a person that you would not realize that you would share a similar future perspective to go into together. So when that became clear, we started thinking about, okay, how can we make this work? And what would be interesting? And basically, scientists think a lot inside of their box, I think. You know, you look at a profile online and you would say, okay, this is an endocrinologist working on diabetes. I'm a translational scientist working on osteoarthritis. These are different diseases. Probably we have nothing in common. But there is much more common ground than we think. Yeah. And I think that's really what I learned, what I appreciate most, I think, in the ECTS Academy, that we actually, also in terms of career development, I think we're much more similar than we are different. And that helps a lot. And I think what also helped me a lot, it also provided me with a support network of people that go through similar experiences career-wise as we are. So from the outside, it might seem like, okay, you were elected into the academy because you were so successful. But success also comes with a toll, basically. And especially for us early career stage, I think, it puts lots of pressure on you. And so we're all dealing with the same issues. How do you deal with this admin heavy task? How do you balance work-life balance? How do you go about in difficult situations with your personnel? Maybe with the dean, maybe at your department. If you miss a promotion? And this is really helpful to go back to this support network outside of your closer academic environment and just have an opportunity to find out that you're not alone in this either. And I think that's one of the things. I mean, we as chairs also talk regularly. I mean, every other week we just have a quick phone call, and it's really, really helpful also on a personal level.
Yeah, I mean, you said you were asked that you're people attending to summarize what they did in one sentence. I won't ask you to do that now, but if you could give us just a very brief summary of what your area, Alex, what are you looking at the moment in your research?
So it's bone mechanoadaptation, so how bone adapts to exercise and disuse. And over the last few years, that's really focused on the earliest stage of life, so prenatal movements and development, motor skills and walking in infancy.
Oh, that's really exciting, because we have talked a lot about getting older people to exercise and the benefits of weight-bearing exercise in older folk. The benefits of exercise in adolescence is also really important. You're actually looking at it sort of pre-birth. That's very exciting.
Yeah, well, I think so. It seems to be quite a profound effect that this is the period at which the skeleton is growing most rapidly. Yeah. I mean, not even as a relative amount, as an absolute amount, the change in body length prenatally, and I mean, I think you go from a single cell to 45 centimetres in 9 months, even in the pubertal growth speed, but you don't do that. So it's a period of unrivaled growth, and it's also a novel opportunity for you to be introduced to loading. So when you are an older person, you might not do a lot of exercise, but you are still walking generally and loading your bones. As a baby, it's a big transition from being on your back to then running about within the space of, you know, a month or two.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
How do you measure activity in utero?
So there's a couple of different ways. There are monitors that you can put on the abdomen, and they can measure movement. We also take different models. So we've looked at babies that are breech. So when babies are in breech position, they're less able to move their legs. And some beautiful mechanical modelling studies that have shown that the loads that you can apply to the womb lining, the uterus lining, and therefore, the forces that are acting on the legs are much lower in children that are breech, and also other conditions like oligohydramnios, etc. So we can use those as kind of reasonable models where we can expect the loading is lower. And actually, there's quite a clear clinical consequence that breech position, for example, is by far the biggest risk factor for developmental dysplasia of the hip.
That's interesting.
Which in turn is a big risk factor for osteoarthritis later on in life.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And Aaron?
That's a nice bridge, because I'm actually working on osteoarthritis.
Well, as soon as he said that, I thought, exactly. We'll move over here, yeah.
Seamless. Perfect, yeah. Seamless, definitely.
Good presenting.
Yeah. Definitely. I have a long-lasting interest in subchondral bone remodeling in osteoarthritis, and I realized that when looking basically at histological images of subchondral bone, that there is a tissue component there that hardly anyone talks about, which is the subchondral bone marrow adipose tissue. And maybe I can ask you a question. What do you think the function of subchondral bone marrow adipose tissue is?
So we're talking about fat then?
We're talking about fat inside of the bone tissue under our cartilage surface.
And if you'd asked 10 years ago, we would have said the fat just sits about there and does absolutely nothing. Whereas now we know it's probably the most metabolically active tissue in the bone and has all these relationships with what's going on in the rest of the body. So yeah, so it's a really exciting area. So that's why we're hoping that you're going to tell us about it.
Exactly. Well, I'm very happy that actually these concepts are better known than I expected, because if I write a grant, and I typically use this statement as well. I say this was considered for a very long time as an inert filler tissue.
At least one clinician has heard of it.
That's good. It's good to know. But indeed, it's much more dynamic than we actually expected, and it also responds very rapidly to different nutritional conditions like overfeeding or even being on a low calorie diet, for instance. And this induces many changes to the actual fat cells. So what we were realizing is, when we think about conditions where you have lots of tissue turnover, or in the case of osteoarthritis, you get lots of bone formation, then we started wondering what is happening with the energy that is stored inside of bone marrow adipose tissue. because what you see is that the bone marrow adipose tissue is disappearing and being gradually replaced by bone. It hasn't helped much in the field that people have used nomenclature to say this is a fibrovascular invasion of bone marrow adipose tissue, which would be a process that's completely opposite to what's actually happening. It's not an invasion of the tissue. It's rather that there's a local expansion of the cells that are there in the hematopoietic niches, for instance, or the stem cell niches. And they need lots of energy, basically, to fuel this process. If you're forming new bone, you're producing collagen, you're mineralizing, and this, in terms of energy, requires quite a lot. You would say the body will use glucose for that, but that's not the case. So elegantly shown in animal models, they actually show that lipolysis in bone marrow adipocytes is very crucial to providing energy to the bone cells.
What's lipolysis?
Lipolysis is the process by which the energy stored in adipocytes or triglycerides get cleaved down to glycerol and free fatty acids, and these are basically energy substrates that can be used by bone tissue. So what we are interested in now is basically trying to understand how does this tissue remodel in an OA versus a non-OA condition. That's the first question. And second of all, can this be a link between obesity and OA that we still understand quite poorly? Because we have been thinking about this in the field for a very long time, and I think for knee osteoarthritis, we agree that loading plays a big part in it. But we're also still baffled by the fact that hand osteoarthritis is also associated with BMI. We don't walk on our hands, so loading is not the only component of it. People in the field then often say, well, then it must be systemic low-grade inflammation. And then I would question again, but why does anti-inflammatory medication then not offer a solution in a way? Yeah. So is this really the case? So that's what my research is focused on right now. We're trying to investigate it also in different types of osteoarthritis. We're investigating base of the thumb OA, hip OA, and knee OA. We are getting clinical samples from patients undergoing knee replacement or joint replacement surgery. We get them fresh from the surgical theater. We isolate the adipocytes. For instance, we do X-band culture of the whole bone marrow unit just to understand if bone formation markers are correlated with lipid release, for instance, from these adipocytes, and try to also modulate this. And the modulation is what we're interested in much right now, is to use anti-diabetic drugs, and we're focusing, of course, a lot on the weight loss drugs that are coming on the market now, because they seem to have, in observational studies, fewer rates of joint replacement in these patients, and we don't know why, but we think that this bone marrow adipose tissue, that these drugs act on that tissue directly. They target also the pathological bone formation that's ongoing, and this might be responsible for less pain and also less progression of disease.
Mm. Wow, what a wonder drug.
It's lovely to see what you do as well outside just being co-chairs of ECTS, and we'll watch the research with interest then.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Well, we're at the airport now, everyone. We're about to travel back home. We've had a really wonderful trip to the conference. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you enjoy listening.
Au revoir tout le monde.